Okay, so I would highly recommend not applying what I'm getting ready to teach you right away. Just play it. I mean, if you think you can, go for it. Good morning, by the way. Good to see you guys. What's that? Number two, that's right. Number two. Who would that be? Commander Data, right? Because didn't Picard, anybody, Bueller, didn't Picard like call Riker number one? So I guess Mr. Data's number two. That's fine. I'm cool with that. Great actor. He once played a character from West Virginia, by the way, if you don't know this, on the show Night Court. Brent Spiner played Mr. Wheeler, and not an accurate representation of the wonderful people from West Virginia. All right, so we are going to get to work today. I bring up not applying this right away because, and you're free to, I'm just kidding. But, you know, I've been doing this work in particular with men who are abusive or what some might refer to as batterers for well over a decade now. And I can tell you, Tuesday night, as a matter of fact, I was back in class for the first time in a while, and we ended class early. Wasn't happening. They got the better of us. We were like, see you later. We'll try again next week. It was just the dynamic shifted, and we could not get them back. So somebody was asking earlier, when do you know that an abuser is duping you? And I'm like, if their mouth is moving. There is, at the very heart of this work, such a heart of pride and deception. And I'm not even saying that the deception is always intentional. I mean, I've worked with so many men who are so self-deceived that I've often said this. I don't need them. Like, I could tell them what's up, right? Counseling could go a lot faster if they would just listen, because I could say, here's the deal. A, B, C, and D, this is what's wrong. Fix it. All right? But they don't need me to tell them. I mean, I know, and I don't need them to tell me. I got a pretty good handle. They need for their own heart to tell me. Does that make sense? I mean, a lot of this work is self-reflection and declaration. So you're really pulling the rope, is what I call it, through good questions and data gathering to really, really, really get that individual to a point where they can utter those words, I was wrong. So that's how I do it for the guys, too, because it's really tricky. Someday, boys, someday you're going to be able to look at your wife and say, I was wrong. All right? So it is tricky work. I would really grow in your knowledge of it. And so it's not like the problem is new. It's not like all of a sudden Pastor Chris walked into seminary here and said, hey, did you guys know domestic violence is a thing? I mean, it's been around since Cain and Abel. That's the first recorded incident of family violence. And so it's not like it's new. So it's not like in an hour or this week for you guys, 2 hours of conversation about a specific topic that we need to go swinging for the fences. We shouldn't be swinging at anybody. Do not use violence in any way against the perpetrator. So today I just want to give you another layer. This builds on to what we talked about last year. If you were in track two, we're just going to layer this on today in the hopes of helping you get a better understanding of the dynamics and impact of domestic abuse. So today we're talking about counseling, controlling husbands. The first time I did this lecture, Rob had asked me to do it because it was years ago. He said, hey, can you add a layer onto that heart of violence talk where we really understand the significance of control? And I was like, sure. And so I think it was just titled Controlling Husbands. I know, right? And it was a topic option night. They had a room full of women. What do you do? What do you do? And I was like, not like that, kiddos. Let's jump into it. One of the questions I receive most frequently is for a definition of abuse. And Steve alluded to this last night with Brad Hambrick's presentation, which, by the way, go to Brad's website and pick that up. He does a really good job visualizing what a lot of us have been trying to articulate, which is when you put abuse into a static category where you're like, here is the definition, right? Here is the sentence by which you judge all abuse. You end up making it a machinery response or a systemic response. And it eliminates some of the wisdom that's necessary. But I want you to imagine for just a minute or think back to the stories you've heard of victims of domestic violence or sexual assault that have been disciplined out of their church. Do you know what I'm talking about? It's happened frequently over the last 10 years. The story goes something like this. A victim of domestic violence has lived under the weight of abuse for a decade or two decades. After finally exposing the abuse to their church leadership, the church leadership launches an investigation. They don't start with, we believe you, we want to help you, how can we learn more about the problem? They began with, well, you know, you got to hear both sides, and what is it, Proverbs 18, 17, right? You know, one seems right until someone comes along to cross-examine, and which is a great principle. Of course, I think I told you last year, Proverbs 18, 18 says, if you still don't know who's telling the truth, cast lots, and I don't see any pastors rolling the dice either. So, I mean, we got to be really, really particular in how we use the Proverbs. But what happens then is this investigation takes a long time, and usually during the investigation, the abuser is recruiting flying monkeys, which is the collusion that happens within the church, and before you know it, the victim's had enough, she files for divorce, and then she gets disciplined from the church. It happens so often, so often. And what I love about Brad doing that construct is what churches have done is the system, the formula, has been eating victims up. Because, well, our policy is this. There has to be wisdom in these cases, right? Because systems don't have souls. Policies don't have ears to hear. So elders, leaders, and godly women, by the way. I think it would be a shame, elders and leaders, if you're an all-male-led church body, if in cases like this you did not involve women. Shame on you. I know I would benefit greatly from a godly woman helping me see my blind spots. And by the way, can you imagine, because this happens a lot. I haven't even got to my notes yet. You guys want to, I'm just going to talk for a minute, then we'll get to the notes. Could you imagine being a female victim of domestic violence or sexual assault, and your church calls you in to try to help you, and you walk into a conference room full of men? It happens all the time, because men, we don't think about things, and all the ladies said amen, right? And what it ends up feeling like, I would guess, I've never been a woman, one, and I've never been in that situation, to be honest with you. I've never been a victim in that regard. So what I'm imagining it feels like is the Inquisition, rather than brothers trying to help. So, domestic violence. So today we want to talk a little bit about what lies at the center of the problem, which is control. You've seen my definition. We talked about this last year. Again, I just poo-pooed definitions, but here's one. We still use language, right? Thank you for that, whoever laughed over here. Thanks, Mom. We still use language, and so as you might recall, I'm going to suggest that domestic violence in particular is first an abuse of power. If you recall, God gave, you know, men are bigger, faster, stronger, so there's a creative advantage, but also within our theological framework, within married couples, husbands have a certain level of responsibility that I think we talked about this maybe yesterday, that responsibility has somehow been morphed into authority, which I think we need to really question that. And then it's manifested through selfishly motivated patterns of behavior. It's always a pattern. Did I tell you guys about the train last year? Bueller, anybody? I don't hear. I'll tell you now. Why not? So several years ago, I mean a long time ago, they had just been given faith, had just been given Bethany Farms, the restoration farm that Rob's talked about, that 100 acres. So my wife and I are here, and we're like, hey, let's go take a look at it. So we go out, we meander out to the farm. And as we're coming back, we come over this rise. I used to call it a hill, but I live in West Virginia, so there aren't. Anyway, we like pop over this little mound, and I see something that I'd never seen before, and it was an entire train in motion. I could see the front of the train, the back of the train, just rolling. And I got really excited. My wife said I needed to get out more, which I do. But I was actually delivering this lecture for the first time, and what struck me about that image was that really captured for me a lot of what domestic violence counseling and care is, because you rarely see the whole train. You see, in West Virginia, we don't see the whole train. There's just too many obstructions. Just trust me on this. I mean, between the hills and the hollers and the bends and the rivers, I mean, you see part of the train, part of the train, part of the train, right? That's just the way it works. Well, that's the way domestic violence care and counseling is. You see snippets. And part of our job as we're pulling the rope and gathering data is to put those pieces together to see the pattern. And abusers are really, really skilled at trying to keep our attention on one boxcar. Another way to look at it, a friend of mine put it this way, it's kind of like we all know what the Big Dipper looks like, I hope. Those stars, you know what I'm talking about? right? No, Chris, I live in the city. I've never seen a star.